Didactic Mind, episode 26, Future World. Very warm welcome, as always, to all of my subscribers from SoundCloud, all of my readers from the blog. Very happy to have you here and to be talking to you. It's not a conversation, obviously, because it's just me talking, but that's fine. We'll try to make the best of it in as much as we can. So, topic of today's podcast is basically to look forward to the future and see what kind of a world we're going to be living in once all of this Kung Flu-related madness is finally over and done with. The fact is that we're going to be living in a very, very different environment, different world, and we can already see some major ramifications coming through, some major changes happening before our eyes. And some of these changes are very good, and some of them are very, very terrible. But I wanted to relate to you, I think, probably five predictions that I reckon are testable and can be measured against, and can be used as yardsticks to see whether I was right. And in all probability, I'm going to get several of these quite badly wrong, and that's fine. I have no problem admitting that I'm wrong. All you need for evidence of that is to look at my blog and look back at the things I've said, you know, some 7 years ago, and I've changed my mind about those things because the evidence proved that I was wrong. But let's start with number one. And probably the most important one, or maybe the most important. My first prediction is that our faith in the power and wisdom of the elites, the governing class, is going to be shattered. And I don't mean eroded, I don't mean weakened, because that's been happening for 20, 30 years already. A full generation has passed since the time of St. Reagan Magnus of the Right, okay? He's dead and gone. May he rest in peace. He was truly the greatest president of the 20th century. Much better than FDR, much better than pretty much anybody of that time period, except for possibly Calvin Coolidge. And Calvin Coolidge didn't face the same challenges that Reagan Magnus did. But a full generation has come of age since that time. And in that time, we have seen the governing class turn into a self-interested, self-aggrandizing elite who have absolutely no regard for the welfare and the happiness and the safety of others. They regard the rest of us as disposable pawns to be used in their power games. But the Kung Flu inadvertently has shown the rest of us just how weak and how stupid and how incompetent these people really are. They are astonishingly frail. They are unbelievably dumb. They have not more than 10 brain cells between all of them, it appears, even though they went to the best schools in the world, even though they have very high IQs, even though they are connected up the wazoo, even though they intermarry and interbreed among themselves. These people are supposedly the best and the brightest, but they're actually incredibly stupid. And the Kung Flu has proven this beyond any shadow of a doubt. The sheer incompetence that we are seeing around the world from governments, government agencies, media organizations, universities, public health officials, every last step of it, every last measure of it is the result of people who focus too much on making the right connections and going to the right schools, and too little on actual practical, useful, day-to-day knowledge. It's the difference between being a Harvard professor and knowing everything there is to know about epidemiology and being a plumber or an electrician and knowing everything there is to know about plumbing systems and toilets and electrical conduits and circuit boards. One kind of knowledge is useful in a theoretical sense, but when put to practical application, turns out to be nearly useless, as we have seen. I mean, every single epidemiological model that we have tried has been so ridiculously far off the reality that we cannot trust them anymore. Every single expert prediction that we have seen has proven to be wrong. Every single attempt by professors to tell us what's going to happen has been laughably, woefully off. Meanwhile, on the other side of the equation, there are the people who actually do things, the people who work with their hands, who are faced, who touch death through their fingertips, as Kipling once said, in his poem, The Sons of Martha. They handle death in their fingertips. These are the people who are out there saving lives every single day, are out there doing their jobs, not asking for any particular reward, just getting on with it and doing what is right and what is necessary, and in the process, keeping the rest of us alive. Make no mistake, if we lined up every last journalist that works for ABCBS, ABC, CNN, CBS, and line them all up, start from one end to the other, and then at the end of that line, we throw in everyone who works for the New York effing Times, everyone who works for the Washington Compost, everyone who works for the Boston Globe, everyone who works for every single, like the Miami-Dade Tribune, the Miami Herald, every single last liberal rag, the Los Angeles, what's it, which one's the liberal newspaper? I think it's the Los Angeles Times. I'm not sure. I could be wrong about that. But if we line them up all one after the other, and basically just comprehensively shot every single one of them, and I'm not advocating for this. Well, no, actually, that's not true. I have advocated for it, and I am honestly at the point where I'm like, you know what? It's probably a good idea. So I'm going to say this openly, and I accept the consequences, and they're going to be pretty severe. I do think that most of the media, most of the dinosaur media, is outright treasonous, deserves to be tried for treason, deserves to be lined up and shot. Now I'm going to say that. I honestly do believe that at this point. If you got rid of all of those people and were just left with the people who actually do things, who actually drive the trucks and stock the shelves and man the pharmacy counters and make sure the metro systems are running and make sure the ambulances are working and make sure that the police cars are still out there on the streets, make sure that people are safe in their homes. Those people are the ones who keep civilization functioning. We don't need the elites, and the elites have proven that repeatedly. We don't need them, and they don't know what they're doing. So the lack of trust in the elites is going to breed some very, very interesting and potentially dangerous phenomena over the next, I'd say, 3 to 5 years. They are going to get ever more desperate to hold on to power because they can see, I mean, the Kung Flu has significantly weakened their grip. They can see it, they can feel it. They know that their sheer incompetence in dealing with this disaster has completely eroded the public trust in them. The American people, despite what the elites say, despite what the media elites in particular say, are not stupid. The American people understand that they have been let down comprehensively by their governing class, particularly by the Democrats, but there are more than a few Republicans who are to blame as well, particularly by the CDC, particularly by transnational globalist bodies like the United Abominations and the World Health Organization, who deserve every last brickbat and every last scintilla of opprobrium heaped upon them. These institutions cannot be trusted and must be destroyed. And that is becoming extremely clear to even the densest American. Even the dumbest and most uneducated and most unaccomplished American, even the most unaccomplished and uneducated Westerner is beginning to see this, and that's a good thing. that is good that these people are getting angry and reacting. The result is going to be the rise to power of far more Donald Trump-like figures than anyone predicted in the past. We've already started seeing it. When his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, may the Lord bless him and preserve him, was elected in 2016. He was part of the first wave of an entire global movement. A global movement with local roots. He was part of the movement that brought to power people like Jair Bolsonaro, I think that's how you pronounce his name, Boris Johnson, Boris the floppy-haired sheep-a-doodle in the UK, Viktor Orban in Hungary, what's his name in Poland, I forget, I can't believe I've forgotten his name, but the Prime Minister of Poland, Matteo Salvini in Italy is out of power right now, but mark my words, he's coming back. He's going to come back with a vengeance. Vladimir Putin in Russia has been there for 20 years. I mean, he is a very firm nationalist. These things are very good signs. These are very, very good things that nationalism is on the rise again. Deep distrust of established government and established order is on the rise. There is a move to push power back to localities and local principalities. This is a very, very good thing. And it's also going to lead to the breakup of various empires, of various heterogeneous empires back into nation states. So that's my second prediction. I agree with our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, Vox Dei, peace be unto him, that the United States is going to break up sometime around 2033, if not sooner. The God Emperor's election and the God Emperor's policies are kind of pushing back that date a bit. But the disastrous response on the part of the government to the Kung Flu by way of truly mind-boggling spending is going to accelerate that day of reckoning. There is simply no way that the US currency is going to sustain itself over the long term, the way things are going right now. Now, I am not an inflationista. I agree with Vox Dei as well that the US currency is not going to be inflated away into oblivion, simply because even the very people who are usually right about economics in all other respects, the Austrians, do not account for the impact of credit and the way in which credit affects the monetary transmission mechanism. Conventional Austrian economics would have you believe that because there's so much money being printed, the inevitable end result is going to be epic inflation, hyperinflation of a kind that the last time we saw it was Zimbabwe. Now, under normal circumstances, that's absolutely true. Americans are not quite normal people. And what I mean by that is that Americans are massively indebted. Now, if you take a country or an economy with very little debt held by the public, or very little personal debt, I should say, the more accurate way to put it is very little personal debt, what's going to happen to the people who don't have much debt? Well, then, when they see an economic collapse coming, their savings are indeed going to be inflated away. But when you combine a massive economic contraction with extremely high levels of personal debt and massive money printing, the transmission mechanism by which all of that new money gets into the economy is broken. Why? Because people in the face of economic contraction are not interested in taking on more debt. They're interested in paying down the debt that already exists on their books. And that is exactly what we're seeing. That's what we saw in 2008, in which the existing, like the shrinkage in personal and corporate debt was offset by a colossal expansion in government debt. And we're seeing it now, in which, again, personal balance sheets are shrinking very rapidly. People are paying off debt. People are avoiding taking on new debt. And that's why all of this money printing that's happening right now is literally the Federal Reserve pushing on a string. The Fed knows its monetary transmission mechanism is broken. They've pushed interest rates down to basically 0%, but it's not working. It's not working because the very transmission mechanism that they rely on isn't working. The transmission between the engine and the wheels is broken. The linkage is broken. So while it is impossible to say that the Federal Reserve could just print however much money it wants and that's not going to have any consequences, that's not true. It is certainly true that we're going to see debt deflation. And with debt deflation comes the unhinging, the destruction of the very economic engine that the United States of America has relied upon for the better part of 40 years. The U.S. economy, certainly since the time of Reagan Magnus, has been a debt-driven economy. It has been a consumption-driven economy. And where personal income is not sufficient to meet the needs and wants and desires of the population, that's where cheap and easy credit has come in. The Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen, Powell, Federal Reserve kind of continuum has been one of cheap money. Paul Volcker was the last probably hard money Federal Reserve chairman that the Fed ever had. Greenspan was the start of the easy money brigade, which is ironic because Greenspan himself used to advocate for gold standard, which is a hard money standard. So, what we're going to see is indeed the destruction of the U.S. currency and the destruction of the United States as a political body. Why? Because the United States of America is not a nation. It's a heterogeneous empire. The various states are basically voting blocks held together by the threat of force. And that has been the case ever since the war between the states. When Lincoln's side won in 1865, the United States of America as a concept, as a nation, lost. The result was not a happy reintegration of brothers and cousins. It was the forced reintegration under occupation of a fundamentally distinct culture. The Southern culture was and remains fundamentally distinct from the Northern culture. And that's been true since the end of that war. The United States of America is actually several different nations glued together into one whole, into a Frankensteinian whole. That is going to disappear as trust in the government declines, as the economy continues to stagger along, and unless significant corrective action is taken to restore the demographics of the United States, there will be no way back. The United States of America will collapse as a concept. There will not be anything to replace it. And the various distinct heterogeneous nations contained within the American empire will reassert themselves. What's that going to look like in the future? Well, I would say there's probably going to be one nation of Northeastern sort of blue state liberals who are very rapidly going to turn into something other than blue state liberals once that happens, because once the breakup happens, it's not going to be the same as it was. I do believe that the South will reassert its primacy and its culture. I do think that Texas will probably become its own country, which it kind of is in most respects. It is basically its own country. I believe that the Midwest will go off and do its own thing. Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, and Canada, and I think Alberta, have long called themselves like Cascadia. They've had their own distinct kind of culture for a long time. California will go off and become a proto-communist hellhole. And the funny thing is, most like Southern California is really where all the lunacy is held. Northern California is actually deeply conservative. The problem is it's sparsely populated. Northern California is not a very densely populated area. It's all Southern California. It's all the idiots in places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego to some extent. I mean, despite the presence of a big Marine base there and a big naval base, the people of Southern California are profoundly stupid in a lot of ways. They're balanced out by their Northern brothers, but the Northern brothers aren't, like, there aren't enough of them. So Hawaii will, I mean, Hawaii has been its own nation for God only knows how long, but once the one dirty little secret of Hawaii is that much of the island, like 50%+ of the economy, as far as I can remember, is government-driven, federal government-driven. So once that's removed, well, what happens then? Hawaii is royally screwed, which means that they'll have to bring the royal family of Hawaii. It still exists. There is still a king in Hawaii. Will have to come back and take charge again. And that's a good thing. That's a very, very good thing. Prediction number three. Having left off on such a dire note, I do believe that the United States of America will break up, if not in 2033. I believe that it will happen latest by 2040. So within 15 to 20 years, the United States of America, as we know it, will be no more. But that was my second prediction. Prediction number three concerns November of 2020. I predict that the God Emperor will be reelected. Of all of the predictions that I've made, I believe this one is the most likely to be wrong. I give it about a 20% chance at this point that I will be wrong. The reason why I am so confident is because if I look at the opposition to the God Emperor, it's completely feckless and ridiculous. And if I look at the way that the God Emperor has matured and developed into the role of president, I mean, he is the best president since Ronald Reagan, the best president since perhaps Andrew Jackson. In some ways, he's better than Reagan was. And that's astonishing to me. I never thought I would say those words. I never thought I would say, well, up until 2016, I never thought we would ever see another president like Reagan ever again. But, I mean, if you look at what the God Emperor has achieved, he has done such great things in such a short span that it's impossible to look at him as anything other than a transformational figure. I never expected the God Emperor to do what he did. I never thought that he would be as effective a leader and as effective an advocate for America as a nation as he has been. He's done a phenomenal job, given the difficulty of the task put in front of him. Has he been perfect? Oh, hell no. I mean, I've been very critical of some of his policies on immigration. And not in the way that, you know, you might think if you're listening to my podcast for the first time. For those of you who are first-time listeners, and maybe one or two of you, you should know, I'm not American, I'm not Western, I'm not even white. I'm Asian. I come from an Asian country. I lived in the USA for 12 years on an H-1B visa. Well, first on an F-1 visa and then on an H-1B. And I think that the God Emperor's policies on immigration are too lax. If it were up to me, I would advocate for him to start mass deportations of everyone who isn't part of the pre-1965 demographics, meaning everyone who isn't basically a bloodline American. And that would result in deportations of like 100 million people, by the way. Like 100 million people, the vast majority of whom have lived in America their whole lives and consider themselves to be American. I have relatives in America, blood relatives of mine, who would fall under this category of people who were born in America, grew up in America, swore, you know, spoke the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag in school, and consider themselves to be thoroughly American. But they're not American. They don't subscribe to the philosophy that is America. They don't subscribe to the idea, or not even the idea, but the genetic heritage of America. They're not part of it. If you look at a nation, you know, what is a nation? It's basically five factors go into the makeup of a nation. Factor number one, genetics. Factor number two, tradition, culture, if you will. Factor number three, history. Factor number four, language. Factor number five, faith. Okay? These five factors are the primary driving forces of what constitutes a nation. Now, if you look at certain nations around the world, they exhibit some of these factors more than others. If you look at Russia, for instance, I know Russia quite well. I've lived in Russia for a long time, relatively speaking. I mean, you know, close to, what, 8-9 months almost, total, if you add everything up. If I look at Russia, Russia is a genetically very diverse group. I mean, you have lots of whites, white, blonde, and brunette Russians in the West, which is where you get most of the really gorgeous Russian blondes from, with, you know, long legs and long hair and beautiful eyes and so on. So I could rhapsodize about Russian women for hours. But that's a separate podcast. But that's where you get the predominantly European admixture from. However, Russia was invaded repeatedly by Central Asians, by the Golden Horde of Genghis Khan and his descendants, and by, eventually by, Tamerlane, and various other kind of, Asiatic invaders. So there is a significant percentage of Russia that is Asian, and you can see it around you. I mean, you walk the streets in Moscow, there are plenty of Russian women who look Asiatic. There are plenty of Russian men who look like they would be basically Chinese, but they're Russian, okay? So, genetically speaking, Russia is diverse, and that diversity grows the farther east you get. By the time you get to the Kamchatka Peninsula, they basically look Chinese. So, if you look at Russia, genetically speaking, it's not a nation. But if you look at it in terms of tradition, history, culture, language, faith, if you talk to, I mean, the interesting thing, one thing that Russians have a hard time understanding about Americans is their accents. If you talk to a Russian from Kaliningrad and you compare his Russian to someone from Vladivostok or from Kamchatka, you can hear the variations in the accents, you can hear the differences in sort of regional speech patterns. But the basic Russian is the same. The language and the script and everything else are the same throughout both ends of the country. It doesn't matter whether you're in the middle of Siberia, in the middle of in the middle of Krasnoyarsk, or in the middle of Moscow. The Russian will sound basically the same. You can tell if you are experienced enough at listening to Russian when someone is from one of the sort of Central Asian republics. Like I can tell that. I can tell. I'm not good enough yet to tell when someone is from Azerbaijan versus Uzbekistan, or when someone is from Moldova versus Georgia, or from Kyrgyzstan versus, I don't know, Sochi, let's say. Before anybody jumps down my throat, I am well aware Sochi is in Russia. I'm making a point that it's, you know, southern Russia, it's around the Black Sea. What I'm saying is that I can tell the differences between someone who speaks Russian as a native Russian from, you know, like a Muscovite speaking Russian from Moscow versus someone from Tajikistan or Dagestan. I can tell that. I can tell that someone is not from Russia. I just can't tell the difference between someone from Dagestan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, you know, the Uzbekistan countries. Anyway, point is, Russians don't understand American accents. They're like, if you listen to Russian dubbing of films, they don't know how to do accents. And their Russian all sounds exactly the same. Whereas in America, of course, the diversity of accents is enormous. In England, it's even greater, in my opinion. I mean, England is a much, much, the UK is a much tinier territory than almost any US state, with some exceptions. I mean, there are plenty of small US states, but if you look at the UK and you look at the regional variations in accents, it's astonishing. But they all speak the same language. Well, they used to, back before the UK allowed itself to be overrun by immigrants. The point of all this is that the USA is not a nation in any meaningful sense. And the God Emperor has faced a tremendous challenge in putting that nation back together. The magnitude of the task before him has been so great that no man could have achieved it. But he has done better than anyone I can think of. There is no man anywhere on earth who could have done what he has done. Now, given the nature of the challenge before him, the God Emperor has risen to meet it with astonishing skill and swiftness. You wouldn't know it listening to the mainstream media. Again, like I said, that's one of the reasons why I think the prostitutes should all be lined up and shot. Or, better yet, I think Madame Guillotine would be a better solution at this point. But the God Emperor has achieved things that no one else thought possible, and he's done it while ensuring peace and prosperity. He's changed the national conversation fundamentally. The thing to remember is that Donald Trump is not the leader of any, like, he is not in and of himself a movement. He is merely the leader of a great movement to restore American pride and strength and power. But the American empire on the whole is on retreat around the world. The disasters of the expeditions in Afghanistan and Iraq were nothing less than utter failures. The US is pulling out of those places. The US is winding down its commitments around the world. The US is pulling back because it cannot project power effectively anymore. Despite all of this, I do believe that the God Emperor will be re-elected. Why? Because of what he has achieved, because of his response to the Kung Flu, which, while the prostitutes go out of their way to devalue and debunk and mock and ridicule it, has actually been quite effective. The figures surrounding the Kung Flu are totally inaccurate, and it's becoming very clear that there's really no tremendous upsurge in deaths. I mean, if you look at the CDC's numbers for deaths in 2020 versus 2019 at the same point, we're actually running a little bit lower in the USA in terms of overall deaths than in 2019. Part of that is undoubtedly because people aren't driving right now. People aren't going out. People aren't doing risky activities. By definition, just by stepping out of the house, you're taking a risk. Even by staying in the house, you're taking a risk. Life is full of risks. But a lot of those risks have really decreased. Even so, given the supposed virulence and danger of the Kung Flu, you would expect that tens of thousands more Americans would be dying than died in 2019. But that's not true. The data do not show this, which leads us to believe, or leads us to the conclusion, that the Kung Flu is really not much more dangerous than the average seasonal flu. In fact, given the fact that the seasonal flu has a vaccine and the Kung Flu does not, what's astonishing is that the Kung Flu kills as few people as it does, relatively speaking. All right? That's food for thought, and that's food to ponder. That's something to ponder for you. But given the nature of the God Emperor's response to the Kung Flu, which I think has been superb on balance, and I strongly disagree with members of my own family about this, but that's what I firmly think, and given the totally inept nature of his opponent, Joe Biden, who is just, I mean, it's the guy isn't all there. I do think he's senile. I do think he's losing his marbles. And given the increasingly credible sexual harassment and assault allegations against him, I do think he's going to be mortally damaged and wounded by the time he faces off against the God Emperor. Joe Biden's response to the Kung Flu has been nothing short of pathetic and rambling and ridiculous. So given, even despite the huge media advantage that Joe Biden will have, I do believe Donald Trump will be reelected as president, because he knows, he understands how to get an economy back on its feet. And that's what we're going to see. Which leads me to my fourth prediction about the US economy. Now, I know things are really grim and really nasty looking right now, but you need to understand that the shutdown that has crippled the US economy and has crippled the global economy is not organic in nature. This isn't something that happened because of a financial market crash or because of a natural disaster. This is something that happened because of a government-mandated cease and desist order on economic activity. Which means that once that government order is lifted, the economy is going to come roaring back. Now, let me caveat that. There are a large number of jobs which existed before this crash, which are never coming back. Okay? A lot of white-collar jobs no longer need offices to host them. A lot of professions are no longer necessary. They're redundant completely. What do we need teachers for when we can homeschool our children? What do we need professors for at vastly overrated, vastly overinflated Ivy League universities when we know, we can see with our own eyes that the products of those universities couldn't find their way out of a paper bag with both hands, a flashlight, a compass, a map, and GPS. They couldn't do it. What do we need these hugely overpaid VPs of diversity and inclusion at places like Yale and Harvard for? What do we need these massive steel and glass office buildings in places like Wall Street and Jersey City, when the back office employees for various banks could easily work from home and just telecommute? They don't need to be in the office. What do we need all of this infrastructure for? It's not necessary. So many jobs are going to just be destroyed because of this, as people realize that there is no need for any of this be in the office nonsense, given the realities of daily life today. Most people could work from home in a white-collar job. And that's been true for several years, but it's like it took the kung flu to really ram this home. A lot of restaurants are going to shut down. A lot of businesses are not coming back. They're just dead, okay? There's no point in pretending that they will come back. The requirements of keeping them open are just too great. They have too much inventory. People aren't going to be spending as much. Those businesses are dead and gone, and that's the way it is. I'm sorry to say this, but tens of millions of people who are out of work right now are going to stay out of work for some months to come, all right? I'm not saying this without empathy, without sympathy. I know what it's like. I've had extended spells of unemployment. You know, when I lost my job in the U.S. and I had to leave, I was out of work for 9 months. When I quit my job with that outsourcing company in Singapore, actually, it wasn't an outsourcing company, but it was it had an outsourcing arm that did kind of software development, and a design arm that did kind of exploratory, you know, projects basically. And I started in as an engineer in the outsourcing arm, and then I went to the design arm. But honestly, I was never involved in anything serious as part of the software side. But that was back in September, like end of September through to now, which is what, 7 months? I haven't worked, okay? So I know what that's like. I know what it's like not to have work. I know what it's like to face crippling anxiety and fear about, you know, where's money going to come from? What am I going to do? How am I going to survive? I've been there. I'm there now. I get it. It's terrifying. It's horrifying. It's soul-crushing, okay? I get it, all right? I know what that experience is like. But that doesn't mean that I try to avoid uncomfortable realities. The reality is many of these jobs that people have lost are not coming back. And some of you listening may well have those jobs. I'm really sorry for you. I truly am. I pray for you. There's nothing much I can do for you, unfortunately, but I am sorry for you. And I wish to heaven that you didn't have to go through this. But things will turn around. There will be new opportunities opening up very quickly. Because for every job that is lost, in every business that is shut down because of complete inability to deal with the massive shock caused by this government shutdown, there will be new ones springing up. Never forget that the people who caused this, the Chinese, the people who are responsible for this, gutted America's manufacturing sector with the absolute willing compliance and help of America's governing elites for decades. That is going to change very rapidly. Companies around the world are seeing that doing business with China is a big mistake. Understand, and I'll get to this in my next prediction, which is about China. Understand that there will be opportunities coming to the USA once again as companies begin to repatriate their businesses and repatriate their workforces and repatriate their earnings. There are also going to be a lot of opportunities opening up for people who have the vision and the skill and the capital to go in and take over failed businesses and retool them. I'll give you an example. Loads and loads of restaurants are going out of business. Yeah, that's true. It's just like they're dead. They're gone. Okay? My cousin, it's a massive cliche in my country of birth. I don't consider it my country, it's just where I was born. But the people of that country have you know, a sentiment about people who own restaurants. Oh, you know, my cousin owns a restaurant. And that's exactly what my cousin does. He's an American. I mean, he was born in America. And he owns a small chain of restaurants. I don't know what's going to happen to that chain of restaurants. I really don't. I don't have a clue. Maybe it'll survive. I hope it does, because I like my cousin. He's a good guy. But there's no guarantee that it will. And if it goes under, he's located in some prime real estate all over Manhattan. When the crash of 2008 happened, a whole bunch of restaurants went bust because the clientele wasn't there anymore, which meant that a whole bunch of other people were able to come in and take over those properties and retool them and turn them into something less expensive. So you saw the rapid rise of like fast dining or casual dining. Chipotle, for instance, expanded massively in the 10 years or so that I was around that business model. From 2009 to 2018 or so, I saw them expand enormously. Why? Because they offered fast, quick, easy dining at a decent price with sit-in options, and you could also take stuff away, and it was a good simple option. It was much lower cost than some of the other restaurants that had been in that area. I distinctly remember walking along the harborfront in Jersey City, in Newport, actually, back in 2012, and there was a Cuban restaurant in one of the office buildings where basically UBS had their back office, middle and back office building. And that Cuban restaurant, my dad and I ate in it back in 2012. It wasn't very good. My dad had to send back a dish because it was really salty. He didn't like it, and they gave us free, you know, flan. As a way of saying sorry. But that business was eventually taken over. It took some time. I mean, it went out of business in sort of 2013, I'm going to say. And it took until about 2016 for that business to be taken over and for that property to be leased out again. But it was. Eventually, something else came along and replaced it. I think it was a nightclub of some kind. I forget exactly, but it was some social thing. There was another place down the road on Cole Street in Jersey City, like literally down the line, down the road, in the Powerhouse District. And that place I saw change hands like three times in the 7 years that I lived in Jersey City. It started out as a restaurant that failed. Then it was taken over by a nightclub that failed. Then it was taken over by a bar that failed, and then it was taken over by another bar. And that, the last time I checked, like the last time I walked by that area, that was still going strong. It was a brew house of some kind, German brew house. So there is dynamism, there is change in the economy at all times. So don't for a moment think that just because jobs have gone now, they're always going to, the people and the properties and the capital is going to stay destroyed. It doesn't work that way. There are going to be new opportunities coming up. Some of these jobs, let's be honest, will never come back. But there will be other jobs coming along to replace them. The sheer amount of pent-up energy in the US economy is going to explode once these restrictions, these idiotic restrictions, frankly, are lifted. My martial arts teacher did a video some weeks back where he talked about how he spoke to his dad, and his dad said, you know, he'd lived through like five wars. I've met his dad, and when I was in Israel in 2014, and his dad told him, Ron, listen to me. When life comes back, it comes roaring back. Everything that you're seeing right now, it's temporary. It's going to go away. And when life comes back, it's going to come back, you know, with an explosion of greenness, of vitality. That's exactly what's going to happen. You're going to see that. I have great hope for the US economy. As long as the God Emperor is in charge, and as long as he doesn't do anything really stupid, which I don't think he will, because he's a businessman and he understands business, I think the US economy is going to come roaring back. Which leads me, in a tangential way, to my fifth and final prediction about China. Now, I believe that China is going to become a much more isolationist power than it has been for some time now. It's going to go back to its old ways as the Middle Kingdom. I have been very outspoken in my views about China and the Chinese people for some time. I don't trust them. Some of the sentiments that I express, a lot of people would call them racist. I don't view them as racist because I actually do genuinely like some of the things about China and the Chinese people. I've been there. I've been to China back in 2001. But I do firmly believe that the Chinese people will revert to type. The Chinese government will revert to type and go back to being an isolationist, deeply hostile imperial power, which is the trend and the template that they've had for like 5,000 years, okay? The Chinese Communist Party, which is almost certainly the agent behind the Chink flu, behind the Kung flu going out there and infecting the entire world, is a very paranoid and fundamentally broken regime. They're going to keep trying to paper over the cracks in their regime by reverting to the tropes that worked in the past of imperial authority and power. Vox Dei believes that this is one of the few areas where I really disagree with Vox. That and the idea that the Kung flu was a deep state operation. I don't believe that's the case at all. I believe it was a Chinese cock-up, and a massive one at that. But Vox Dei believes that the next century will belong to China. I actually agree with him up to a point, but I don't think the Chinese system is set up for success. I do believe that China will take eventual dominance and control over the South China Sea and over its immediate surroundings, but I don't believe it's going to be an imperial power to the degree that the United States was. It doesn't have the strength, and it doesn't have the resources, and it sure as hell doesn't have the programming for it. It doesn't have the vitality. See, the thing about East Asian culture is, because of its Confucian roots, and because of its emphasis on top-down obedience to authority, it's a very static society. It results in stasis, and that's been the pattern over and over and over and over and over again. When you look at Chinese, South Korean, and Japanese history, well, Korean history, every single time that these countries have achieved greatness, they have insisted on keeping things the way they are. They have insisted on freezing things, you know, cutting themselves off from the outside world, being isolationist, and developing internally. And they have done a phenomenal job. I mean, if you look at Chinese culture during its most isolationist phase, during the times of the Tang, Ming, and early Qing dynasties. Not Qin, Qing, meaning the Manchu dynasty that was the last one to rule China. They achieved tremendous things. They achieved astonishing heights of art and culture. But they did it in a time of basically self-imposed isolation, where they viewed themselves as the Middle Kingdom, the center of the earth, the center of the world, the kind of the barrier, or the middle point between heaven and hell. Okay? That's what Chinese society is like, and that's what the Chinese people are like. They believe in structure, in obedience, in meritocracy, and above all, in conformity. This is not a dynamic people. If you look at the way Chinese businessmen operate versus the way American businessmen operate, big Chinese businessmen operate by taking advantage of state power. That's their entire MO. It's the same way that Indian businessmen operate, by the way. They take advantage of stupid, idiotic regulations in a broken government. And they use those loopholes and those entryways to create opportunities for themselves. Americans and Westerners operate very differently overall. I mean, once they get to a certain point, obviously they operate as arms of the government, as all big businesses do. It's a fundamental law of business that once you reach a certain critical threshold of size, you become an instrument of government policy no matter what. And that's invariant between countries and cultures. I mean, it's as true of Russia as it is of Britain, as it is of America, as it is of Brazil, okay? Happens everywhere. But if you look at the way that American businesses start and the way that American business culture operates, Americans fundamentally believe in the best idea winning out in the end. They fundamentally believe in the power of individuals to do what they want to do. Chinese don't think that way. Japanese really don't think that way. They believe in the power of the collective. And that is why, if you look at the way Chinese business culture operates, if you're in a meeting with in a Chinese company, everything looks fantastic. Everything looks amazing. You're presented with the image of astonishing competence and skill, but deep down, there's a lot of rot that goes on because nobody ever dares to question the boss to his face. All the kind of disagreement and the dissension and the kind of horse trading, that all goes on behind the scenes. That happens in the bar after work. That happens when people are able to let their hair down a little bit. It doesn't happen to people's faces. And face is a critical concept in East Asian culture, which Americans don't really understand. It's very hard for them to figure out how this works, but it's a very important part of their cult of East Asian culture. Because of the enormous loss of face that has occurred for China, they're going really hard on the offensive, publicity-wise, to cover up their tracks. But they can't get rid of the stigma that has resulted. I mean, people around the world are waking up to realize that China is the enemy. Maybe not as deadly an enemy as the Soviet Union was, maybe not as alien, but in some ways just as bad, and in some ways actually worse, in some small but important ways worse. They understand, like the Chinese understand how to use Western tools of trade warfare and economic warfare better than Westerners do. They watched the Western economies use poison pills of debt and sweetheart loans to the dirt world in the 1980s, and they learned their lessons really well. They are now doing exactly the same thing on a much bigger scale, with much more profound effects in shithole countries in Africa, in Asia, and they're doing a great job. But a lot of those same countries are now looking at China and going, no way. No, we're not doing business with you anymore. They're pulling back. Now, time will tell. The almighty dollar, or eventually probably the almighty yuan, will speak for itself at some point. But I do think that the Chinese are facing something of an existential crisis. The Chinese people have now seen how incompetent and useless and feckless the CCP is. When you combine that with the fact that China's economy is going to take an absolute pantsing, I mean, they're really going to take it in the short trousers right now, because they're very export-driven and very manufacturing-driven. And the world's demand for cheap Chinese shit has really fallen off a cliff. You're going to see tremendous social upheaval and unrest. And if that extends out longer than a year or two, which I believe it will, because Donald Trump's policies about China have been vindicated completely and thoroughly. And if Donald Trump is reelected, which I believe he will be, if the God Emperor returns to the cherry blossom throne, which I believe he will, I think that we are going to see an acceleration of anti-China trade policies throughout the Western world. Because everyone can now see what China has done and how disastrous the Chinese way of doing things is and how unreliable China is as a trading partner. Now, again, this is not racist rhetoric. This is not anti-Chinese per se. While I do not like Chinese culture and I do not like the Chinese mindset, I hold no particular ill will against individual Chinese. I have worked with Chinese people all my life. And, you know, individually, I think they're swell people overall, with quite a number of exceptions that I can think of from my own personal experience. But overall, I think they're just decent people. They try to get on with their lives as best they can, and they do what they can when they can. But their way of thinking, their culture, especially their system of government, is totally alien to anyone who admires and reveres Western civilization. It is anti-Western, literally anti-Western, which means that it cannot be compatible with the West, and which means that Western countries are going to have to confront the hard reality that the Chinese people living among them are not them, and they need to go. They need to go back to China. So I do think that people are going to come to that conclusion eventually, and it's going to be a very unpleasant process of coming to that conclusion, but it's going to become a very necessary process. And given what I have experienced of Chinese management styles and customs, for which I have great disdain, because Chinese people hire Chinese people. I mean, if you want, you know, people think that it's racist to say that that there's something wrong with Chinese culture. Well, guess what? The biggest racists you will ever meet in your life are always Chinese, always and every time. Their way of doing things is inherently dis-civic relative to the Western way of doing things. And they're going to pay a price for that. And I do believe that they're going to retreat into some kind of serious isolationism. And I do believe that's going to have some pretty dramatic consequences for the rest of the world. Because what happens when China becomes isolationist is one of two things. Either it technologically stagnates and regresses, which is what happened by the time the Opium Wars took place. And, you know, the West kicked the crap out of China as a result. Or in a globalized world like we have now, where the Chinese can, you know, shut down their own internet at will, they're going to develop into a paranoid, insular, very repressive, very dangerous culture which regards everyone else as an enemy. And now they have nukes, and they have debt trap instruments that they can put to use, and they have carrier fleets, and they have not very good stealth planes, but they have stealth technology. So they will become a very dangerous opponent in the next 10 years. Mark my words. They already are a very dangerous opponent. They already are technically basically at war with the West and have been for a very long time. And we should not delude ourselves about that. We should not be beholden to illusions about that. Anyway, we are rapidly coming up on the 60-minute mark, so I will wrap things up here. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you have not subscribed, please make sure that you hit that subscribe button. Share out this podcast with those that you like or just want to annoy, or want, you know, any liberal friends whose heads you want to see explode. I will happily take credit for doing that. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 26. Future World. I am Didact, and I will see you on the next one.